Once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We did that okay. Although my mic seems a little low. Is it seem a little low to you?
No. All right. Sounds the same as mine.
All right. Well, at this point, we're supposed to tell you that the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, which is being brought to you live and in living sound on August 11th, 2018. It is also the name of an SEC registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that does wealth management work and investment management for people with adequate net worth.
Adequate to retire?
Yeah, adequate to live comfortably. And it is also a fact that despite the fact that the two guys on here, Jeff and
Jake.
Ah, you did that. You caught that. That was good.
I was going to leave some dead air, okay. But I decided to say my name instead.
You could be. It could have just been Jeff and...
Well, next time you pause, I'll just throw my name out there again. So if you're in the middle of... what is it that the president said about Jake?
Jeff.
Easy way to... Okay.
I could say and Jeff, but if you say Jake and... See, that's what you have to say. You see, you have to say Jake and.
Jake
see,
and.
Jeff.
Jeff.
See, that'll work too.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, even though we are the principals and the guys who do most of the advising at the Personal Wealth Coach investment firm, we are not giving investment advice here today. We are educating or trying to educate or entertaining or something, maybe boring.
Yeah, that's maybe, probably the consensus at this point. We're
probably
boring.
Filling the airwaves with inanities. But, and also the stuff we get and we talk about here is from sources we believe to be reliable, and we're really careful about that. But we don't make any guarantees or warranties that it's completely accurate, because it's really, really hard to tell what's completely accurate sometimes. Let's see what else we got to say. Town Square Media is Town Square Media, and the Personal Wealth Coach is the Personal Wealth Coach, and our opinions and their opinions do not necessarily coincide.
Yeah.
And our stuff we say has nothing to do with them, and the stuff they say has nothing to do with us, which means that if you hear a commercial on this radio program, we did
not approve this commercial.
You know what's funny? Opinions don't coincide, but we are inside the studio with them. So we coincide. Our opinions don't. So I guess we checked them at the door?
No, I bring my own opinion in. Thank you very much.
But they're coincide then, if you say they don't coincide.
No, I think Town Square Median's opinions left on Friday.
Oh, that could be it. They're not here.
They went home on Friday, and we're sitting here at KTM's closet studio. And trying to make sense of the world. But the telephone number in here, if you would like to call and join us with your comments, thoughts, or questions regarding the economy, economic stuff in general, investments, things of that nature, would be 254-773-1400. And there's actually two different lines that goes to, which is a major advance from where we used to be.
Well, and a major step back from where we were before that.
Yeah. Well,
We can just measure at different points, just like the market.
Yes, we could measure at different points. Well, let's see. We had a week, and it was an interesting week. We had 5 weeks previous during which the major indices, like the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ Composite and so on, all went up, which was pretty good. That was a fine thing, and people were talking about the fact that we were getting close to the record levels that were set on January 26th, just before all the tariff talk started. And it didn't work out this week. The S&P 500 actually dropped 0.25% for the week. Year to date, it's still up almost 6%. For a one-year period, it looks really good. It's up 16%. That's going to start to go away in the near future because we'll start climbing up that slope that we saw towards the end of last year. But, the Dow is down about 0.6%. Year to date, the Dow is only up 2.4%, which is okay. The Treasury yield dropped back a little bit, and it dropped back for a very simple reason. The same reason that right on the last day, the S&P 500, the Dow, and the other indices dropped, and that is that because we used to have a lot of problem with perhaps Greece catching on fire, and now it's the Turkey that seems to be in trouble.
Yeah, the Turksic, only they're not exiting anything.
Yeah, only they got a, it's a lira. Lira?
Yeah, and it's in trouble because of us.
Well, not necessarily.
Big chunk of it.
Some of it. We're this is a word for the day, exacerbating the issue.
Wait a minute. Coincide exacerbation. That sounds dirty.
Well, it does, but we're exacerbating the issue a bit with putting some threatening bigger tariffs on their steel.
And aluminum.
But they basically are doing it all to themselves. The lira has started, is crunched downward ever since their president, who basically awarded himself almost dictatorial powers.
He didn't award it to himself. He just accepted it when the people who were his lackeys awarded it to him.
Okay, well, he...
It's a different thing.
He basically arrested anyone who wouldn't award it to him and put them
right
in prison.
And then, oh, thank you so much for giving me these powers.
Yes, and
right?
he's got all these powers, and he took his son-in-law and put him in charge of both the treasury and finance and everything to do in the central bank, and decided not to raise interest rates as inflation started soaring upward. Why is inflation soaring upward? Well, because his government's spending a lot of money they don't have, to make people happy. And as a result, the inflation rate there is roughly 23% a year right now and rising very quickly. Then, in the midst of all of this, he's got, I think 16 Americans imprisoned, one of whom is a pastor who's a cause célèbre, as they call it.
Oh, wait, you used French there. You got to excuse that.
He's really,
excuse your French there. Did you say cause célèbre?
I did.
I think that would be celebrity cause.
Well,
is that a
popular
reality television show?
He's a popular cause.
He is a popular cause.
And
they're also upset with us because the scapegoat for the coup lives in the United States. The scapegoat for the coup. That's a cool shirt. Somebody should just get that on their shirt. Scapegoat for the coup.
It is, and the United States does not agree with President for Life Erdogan that the fellow who lives in the United States caused the coup where the armed forces rose up against him in Turkey. At any rate, Erdogan's got several Americans, one of whom is a pastor, accused of treason, and he recently kind of budged a little bit and put him under house arrest. But there's quite a few Americans who just were caught up in the broad sweep and were arrested, and the rest of them are still in prison. And President Trump has told them, you really need to release these people because they didn't have anything to do with your coup. You just release them and let them come home. And in exchange, we've got one guy in prison here who really was a spy for Turkey and who really was doing bad things and got convicted in court, and we'll let him go, and then we'll all be nice. But Erdogan decided that he didn't want to do that, and the president, exercising his powers, keeps exercising more powers. And so we got this, it's an interesting situation because I don't think in the past we would have done this. We would have used much more subtle means. And the reason is there's a lot of European banks and that have outstanding loans in Turkey that are dollar based.
Yeah.
And the end result is that the likelihood of those loans getting repaid declines every time the Turkish currency drops. And the Turkish currency is in a big hurt. Again, we're exacerbating that here, hurt. And to give you some idea, you may think, well, this is all just stuff going on over there. And I initially thought the same thing.
It's important.
BBVA, I think it's called. Anyway, it's the Spanish bank that bought Compass Bank here in the United States, which has a branch in Salado, is one of the banks that potentially is at risk. And we're in a global economy, whether we like it or not. And the fact is that if the European economy, which is kind of in a teetering position right now, were to suddenly take a big hit from Turkey's financial collapse, which is certainly not, which is not a certainty by any stretch of the imagination, but if Turkey were to collapse financially and say we're not paying back any loans, it would probably cause the Europeans to drop back into recession. It would cause a minor crisis in Europe.
Spain is barely peeking out of recession for very short periods of time and then falling back in. And then now it's kind of peeking out of recession again and having BBVA fail to be paid by Turkey would...
And it could make them insolvent. Nobody, this is the point, nobody, unlike a bank in the United States with our banking rules under Dodd-Frank,
And the Federal Reserve
and the Federal, but I mean, the Dodd-Frank says the banks have to make public their degree of dependence upon another country. And in Europe, that is just not the way it is. I mean, and in the result, nobody knows for sure how much exposure there is to Turkey and what secondaries and
tertiary Turkey exposure.
And
that's what happens to me in Thanksgiving.
And there's and this has a ripple effect that I think is pretty fascinating. One, it caused...
That happens to me at Thanksgiving, too. I get a ripple effect for sure.
I get a bloating effect from the turkey. But it caused the U.S. markets to decline, which you would think would be weird. Why is that? And it caused the dollar to rise significantly.
That's not a good thing for our foreign trade.
Right, which means our exports will tend to decline if the dollar stays up.
And our imports will tend to.
And our imports will increase. By the way, in the middle of this, it exacerbated, this whole process exacerbated something else. The yuan renminbi, which is the
Chinese currency,
has now fallen enough that it effectively negates the across-the-board 10% tariffs that President Trump, imposed on them, which is irritating the fire out of him because it made their goods enough cheaper that it offset the 10% tariffs.
Right, but it's still more expensive to us. So they're getting still getting the same amount of profit, but the Chinese goods are more expensive to us.
Actually, no, their price went down, and the tariffs got added on to it.
But they
stayed basically the same price, and then that's my understanding anyway.
Okay,
but the point is, whether we like it or not, something that's going on in Turkey, a dictator in Turkey, he's a president, he was elected, who basically says, by the way, they have a motto there in Turkish, which is Turkey first. I'm not joking, folks. He basically says Turkey can go it alone, it can wage war with whoever economically, and it'll win. I don't necessarily agree with him, but it is an interesting world in which there's a lot of fragmentation going on. The Brexit is coming up. But what this does, and this is one of the most fascinating things, is to close out my long introduction here. The gold, you would think, okay, there's crisis, there's fear. There's echoes of 1998. I don't know who remembers what happened in 1998. That's ancient history now.
The Asian contagion.
When we had an emerging market meltdown that started unexpectedly with a single country that got in trouble with its currency. So there's memories of that in investors. So they actually can remember 10 years, but that's about it.
Wait a minute. 10 years... From when? Because that 20 was 20 years.
Oh, well, 20 years. 10 years, 20 years. What's the
difference? It kind of blurs together at this point. They have a zero at the end.
But there are some striking similarities here to what happened 20 years ago. But the point in all of this is that I wanted to make. Historically, we look back and we have this mythology about gold that says in times of crisis and fragmentation, when things look like they're going to fall apart, gold rises and the dollar falls. But what's actually happening in the world is people are buying dollars because they consider them to be secure, and they appear to be selling gold. Gold is down about 8% this year. The dollar is up actually about that amount, about 6% this year. And that's a pretty amazing change in the world, in that the rest of the world may not like the United States very much, but when it comes to a crisis, they buy dollars.
Right. I'm going to do a subject change, if you don't mind.
Certainly.
I want to talk about Chris Collins. Do you know the representative from New York insider trading issue?
Well, you know, I mean, like, we're insider broadcasters.
Right, right. Exactly.
He was an insider. Well, actually, he didn't do the insider trading.
Well, this
he just
is,
made a telephone call.
Right. Here, well, more than one.
Oh.
Multiple
times.
We made
several telephone calls.
Here's the deal. People talk to us about this. They're upset because Congress, you know, congressional folks get elected and they have a net worth somewhere way down in the bottom of the bucket. And they serve their terms in Congress and they come out at the end of it with these huge net worths. Part of the reason for that is that insider trading laws are different for Congress than they are for anybody else. There used to be no insider trading laws that covered Congress. And just a few years back, the Republican Congress said, we got to fix that. That's corruption. And you heard us trumpeting it. We were very happy about
trumpeting?
It.
Trumpeting?
Yes. Well, that's trumpeting. Yes.
Yes.
We were very happy about it because...
Drain the swamp.
Anytime you can drain the swamp, we're going to be happy about it. The idea that Congress could benefit from something that nobody else, they get to sit in committee meetings with CEOs of companies that are closed-door meetings, and the CEOs must divulge non-public information. That's the sort of thing that if you were not a member of Congress, you wouldn't be able to trade on that stuff. Well, they changed the law for themselves. They made a new law for themselves. And it's still not illegal in the same sense. It's not illegal for them to trade on that information. They get referred to the ethics committee, and there's some fines and some other punishments that the ethics committee can lay on them. Here's the thing with Chris Collins. He got arrested, and he got arrested for insider trading. And on the surface of it, you would say, wait a minute, just hold on just a sec. Jake, didn't you just say that this just gets referred to the ethics committee? You're correct, as long as he was trading his own account. Instead, he was calling his son, and his son was trading, and his son's broker was trading, and his son's father-in-law was trading.
Of course, he is also on the board of directors of the company he was trading, and he got inside information as a member of the board of directors, not as a member of Congress.
Right.
And he
got
it. The funny thing is, he got it at a White House reception.
Yeah.
And he called...
On the front lawn.
On the front line of the White House, as if no one ever monitors cell phone activity at the White House.
Even if they hadn't been monitoring it there, it would have been very simple for the SEC, who watches this stuff. If you're a board member of a company and one of your family members is trading before a big movement, they watch that. It's their job. That's what law enforcement is for. You're cheating. That is directly stealing from the other people involved in the marketplace. It's like taking money from from everybody else involved. And it's spread out across everybody, but you still can't do that. It's not right. So now it's become political because this is a guy that endorsed the president very, very early on, and it looks like a political witch hunt. But I have to come back and say, hey, I was for the change in the law to make it at least unethical to do insider trading while in Congress. It was a Republican passed idea. Trump loved the idea. Now we come forward, and I'm sorry, but if you break the law, it doesn't matter which side you're on. The law was written by the Republicans. It should be followed by the Republicans as well as everybody else. So that I wanted to bring that up because there's a lot of confusion about it.
He also, by the way, has already been identified as probably doing insider trading based on congressional knowledge, and he was removed from a committee that was overseeing legal drug use.
Yeah.
And he had pushed through a bill speeding up the process of releasing drugs, which helped him. And he basically apparently did some trading based on what came out of that committee. And he was already under investigation and had already been removed from the committee because they concluded he probably was doing insider trading.
So we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Okay, guys, enjoy the show as usual. There was an article in the Fortune magazine this week, and it quoted Ben Bernanke, and he he basically characterizes the recent federal tax cut as a stimulus, and he said that he said that the stimulus is arriving at the very wrong point in time because of the economy is already at full employment. I'd like to see what you guys think about that comment. Thank you. I'll hang up.
All right. Fantastic.
Thank you.
That is a that's an amazing.
And we've already talked about that before, but we'll talk, not on this show.
There are two kind of major schools of economic thought that have been endorsed by the two political parties. There's Keynesianism, and then there's the laissez-faire Milton Friedman approach.
Now you're going French again.
Right. Laissez-faire.
I'm not lazy. I'm not. I don't go to no laissez-faires.
So this concept of government shouldn't be involved was a Milton Friedman approach, and the government should be really involved is the Keynesian approach. Well, at least that's the interpretation. Something that both of them agreed upon. This is hard to find if you look in the political material, but if you actually read their work, it's really easy to find. Is that if the government's going to get involved and stimulate the economy, it should do it in times of recession. It should step in when things are going very poorly to stimulate the economy. If you're going to lower taxes to stimulate growth, you should do it at a point when you can get the most bang for the buck, when there are a lot of people unemployed. If you do it when people are already employed, it doesn't matter the stimulus. You can lower taxes. You can give money back in your taxes. It amounts to the same thing, more money in the pockets of the taxpayer. If you do it at a point when employment is already full, you're stimulating inflation because this is something, this is a truism of innovation. If you look at the bottoms of recessions and you go back throughout the history of the United States and before, and you look at these bottoms of these depressions and these recessions, that's when innovation occurs. If you think about Michael Dell or Henry Ford, something that is similar in both cases. Now, Michael Ford was a student at the time, but he dropped...
Michael Ford.
I'm combining them.
Boy.
Michael Dell. Henry Dell. Michael Ford. Michael Dell was a student, but he dropped out of school to do this business. Henry Ford had been laid off. Thomas Edison was in a place where he didn't have work. If you look at the big innovative jumps that we have, it's because people are unemployed. If you can stimulate them at that point, give them the ability to finish starting their businesses, then you get this big innovation. If you take an economy that's already doing well and you stimulate it, you can increase the speed of the economy. We're watching that right now. But it also adds to inflation in a way because there's more money for the same amount of work. If they could do more work for that money, it wouldn't stimulate inflation. If they could create more stuff for that money, it wouldn't stimulate inflation. But if you have extra money and so does most everybody else, it just causes prices to go up.
And prices are currently rising year over year. The consumer price index for all cities in the United States is averaging 2.9%, which is really close to 3.
Which is very close to what we're thinking the GDP is going to be.
And that is not a particularly good thing, particularly since it is accelerating.
Well, let me throw this out there. The gross domestic product, the GDP, is inflation adjusted.
Mm-hmm.
So we're getting growth above inflation. But when we look at inflation growth and we look at GDP growth and we say, how sustainable is the GDP growth? Well, we've just had a one quarter of 4.1%. That's fantastic. That's great growth. Looking around, and by the way, just go back and listen to this, the recordings of this radio broadcast. You're going to go to our webpage, tpwc.com, and go back and listen. And you'll find that that's almost on the dot what we were predicting months and months ago.
Yeah, when the tax cut first passed, we said, this is stimulus at the wrong time. This is going to...
Expect second quarter GDP growth to be in the 4% range and expect it to fall after that.
Frankly, and I've said this a couple of times, and we've said it in the newsletter, this is a grand macroeconomic experiment, and it reminds me a lot of Vietnam. Vietnam, there's a book called On War by von Clausewitz.
Yeah, kind of a seminal, which it's important to work.
And it basically says, if here's the principles of war, and if you follow the principles, you win, and if you don't follow the principles, you lose. And the side that follows the principles more closely always wins. And when we went into Vietnam, it's an amazing, if you look at the principles of war, we violated every single principle of war, and we lost for the first time in the history of the United States. We actually lost war. A lot of people, we really didn't lose. Yes, we did. We got kicked out of the country. But the economics, both major schools of economics, Herman Minsky's school, everybody,
all the schools,
that doing a massive tax cut and running up huge debts when the economy is already surging is a bad idea, because it will produce what Moody's Analytics refers to as a sugar high.
Right.
It's kind of like a kid that's eating a lot of sugar and is going to run around and being crazy and
he's
has lots of energy.
Coming.
And you know, if you've been around a three-year-old at that point, that there is a crash coming. And there is going to be an economic crash.
Not a huge
economic
one.
Theory states that this our word for the day is exacerbate. Remember that. It's going to exacerbate what was already probably going to be a cyclical downturn in 2020. So instead of doing what the Federal Reserve likes to do and what we've traditionally thought was good economic policy, which is to cushion those downturns and dampen the upside a little bit, the tax cut did the exact opposite.
Right.
And it's causing the dollar to rise. It's causing interest rates to rise. And I've got a story here.
And inflation to come up.
And I've got an interesting story about what it's doing to the deficit, too.
Yeah, it's a good statement. I've got some other things to bring up here. Right in the middle of that, the trade issues are happening. And you've heard us say this before, but I want to repeat it because it's important. If we were going to make this experiment, the trade war issues, now's the perfect time to do it. I don't think that it's a great idea, but now is the time to do this kind of experiment, because we're flush with cash. We got lots of cash. We are in a place where everybody that really wants a job has a job within reason. There are still people looking for jobs out there, don't get me wrong. Just not very many of them. The vast majority of people that want a job have a job. There's income coming in. Incomes are up. If we look back at what incomes were before the recession, we're above that now. We're in a place where we have personal cushions. Part of that is from the tax cut. And now we're experimenting with a trade war. Well, this is a time when we have the most cushion to do it. Normally, this would have a much larger drain on the economy than what we're seeing.
One of the problems with the trade war, and this is our point, there's a lot of the points that President Trump makes about what China's doing and what other people are doing that do require some attention and did and do merit some effort. But very frankly, and I read this the other day and I thought it was a very appropriate description, it's like discovering that you have cockroaches and deciding to go after them with a sledgehammer.
Right.
Your house.
You're going to damage more than the cockroach. And you may get the cockroach. Don't get me wrong. I don't like cockroaches. But you're probably going to hurt your house more than you hurt cumulatively the cockroaches.
And I don't know if you read the most recent tweets on this, but the president has now decided to ratchet up you're going to put a 25% tariff on cars and car parts imported from Canada.
Yeah.
Which is...
That's using the sledgehammer on your toe. That's not even using the sledgehammer on a cockroach, because Canada doesn't have any car companies that are Canadian-owned.
Right.
Just think about that for a second. Who owns the companies that are now having the tariffs put on them? And this may be an effort by the president to say, well, Ford and General Motors... close down your plants in Canada and open them up in the United States. That's probably what it is. But that's not how he's stating it in his tweets. He's stating it as a statement against Canada, not who's going to be the ones that lose the most here. And it's Americans, because Ford and General Motors are owned by the United States. They're owned by the citizens of the United States, and it's going to cut into their profit drastically. So the profit cut is going to be felt more by the shareholders than by the people who are working in Canada. The Canadian workers are not getting as much as the profit in their pay, because it's a large amount. They're making parts there that are being shipped down into the United States to be used again in manufacturing facilities here. They're being shipped up there to be manufactured.
And an argument by the major automobile manufacturing firms is really simple. They may have maybe making a nice profit, but to build a whole new set of plants down here after they've already built them in Canada would be very expensive to begin with. The second thing is they are fairly well convinced, because they've got labor shortages now, that they will not be able to find enough people to work in the plants if they built them, because they're just as, and unemployment is just too low in the United States, and they just can't find the people to work. And so we talk about this, we're on a sugar high. That's what the question was about. How is it that we got on a sugar high? Well, because we gave the American people a lot of money. Now, you can say, well, no, we didn't. We just didn't take it out of their paychecks. By the way, when you look at the dollar value of the tax cuts, the corporate tax cut down to 21% is a drop in the bucket compared with the personal tax cuts that came with this bill. And in essence, the economy is running really hot and really fast right now. This is the bottom line to it. The United States government has determined that borrowing money from overseas and giving it to Americans will make our economy run faster. So our economy is doing really, really well by borrowing money from people outside the United States. And if you think about that just for a few minutes,
you can see where we have a problem with that.
It's kind of like if our business was going along just fine and we decided we could improve our bottom line by borrowing a lot of money and placing that in our bank accounts. And so our bank accounts would get much bigger, and we could go buy a bunch of stuff we probably don't particularly need, and it would make our office look really nice. And we did it all with borrowed money, and we say our business is picked. Look how much our business has picked up.
That's not a really good way of doing business.
And in case you think I'm being unduly alarmist, you got something?
Yeah, I want to add something in a moment.
Okay. In case you think I'm unduly alarmist, this is in the Wall Street Journal, August 10th, 3:29 p.m. The Treasury made an announcement. They announced that the amount of money the federal government spent and what it took in, the difference, totaled $684 billion in October through July. That's $0.68 trillion just in October through July. Remember that last year the tax cut wasn't in effect. So it's basically what's occurred from January forward. And to show you how it's concentrated on the near end, the federal budget deficit in July, just July, was $77 billion, which is 79% higher than last year's July deficit. We have seen in 1 year, the monthly deficit, the difference between what the government takes in and what it spends, rise by 79%, and that can be accredited to only two things. It's, our economy is running just fine, which means it's not like there's a slump in the economy that caused people not to pay as many taxes. People are actually paying, they're actually making more money. But the bottom line to it is we spent, so far this year, this fiscal year, and only half of that has been under the new tax law, the government has seen decreased revenues of 3% and increased spending by 10%. And this, and I want to, listeners, I want you to listen a second. I want you to think back a few years to the position of the Republicans just a few years ago, the Republicans who passed the bills to do this. The deficits were bad, and we're going to run ourselves bankrupt.
Right. No more debts. Don't increase the debt ceiling. That's, I mean, we shut down the government twice based on this. And to see it from the completely opposite side, it's a little startling. The thing I wanted to add about this, because we're dealing with exactly the same situation. I'm going to talk about Harley-Davidson. Harley Davidson is an American company. It is kind of synonymous with American companies. You have Bourbon, Levi's. Levi's have had plants in China and all over the world for a long time. So Harley Davidson is one of the last major holdouts to say, we're not going to make our motorcycles elsewhere. They have been making their brake pads in Vietnam, but the majority of their parts have been American-made, and the bikes are manufactured by Americans in American plants. And they're very proud of that. They've been very proud of that since the decades, beginning of Harley-Davidson. This is a big deal to them. The tariffs on steel hurt. Tariffs on aluminum hurt. It hurts Harley-Davidson. They're looking at that. We need those things to build parts. The response tariffs on Harley-Davidson bikes in China and in Europe, these are the two growth areas for Harley-Davidson. So let me kind of step back and say, if they're an American company and they're made in America and they're sold in America, what could be the problem here? Well, the problem is the baby boomers are getting older. And there are a lot more baby boomers that buy Harley-Davidsons than there are any of the other generations put together. And they're buying less Harley-Davidsons. The prices have been going up.
And there's another factor.
What's that?
There aren't, and I have heard nothing about putting tariffs on motorcycles being imported in the United States, so I presume that motorcycles are not being tariffed. If you buy a Honda motorcycle that looks a lot like a Harley-Davidson...
Or a BMW, A BMW for a comparable price.
They were able to build that BMW or that Harley with steel that costs 50% less... Honda or BMW motorcycle. They were able to build it with steel that costs 50% less than it costs in the United States. Why does it cost so much in the United States? Because we put tariffs on it.
Right.
And our domestic manufacturers raised their prices to match the import prices. They didn't say, well, let's have American. It would be ideal if the Americans said, hey, we'll give you cheaper steel than the imported steel,
right,
which is the thought process. But no, they raised their prices to be the same. So now American manufacturers have to pay 50% more for steel than do foreign manufacturers.
Even before the tariffs, even before any of these issues that we're bringing up on trade, Harley-Davidson sales have been dropping. They've been dropping every year for about 5 years. 5 years ago, their price was 25% higher than it is today on the stock price. They're looking at the fact that their market is shrinking in the United States. There's fewer people buying Harleys every year. Part of that is because of price. Part of that is because it doesn't matter as much to a younger generation whether they're buying a Honda, a BMW, or a Harley. So come forward to now, they have two markets where they're selling more over the last 3 years, selling more than they had the year before, and that's Europe and Asia. People were buying them because of their American quality, because of what they were in America. So after the tariffs, after the response tariffs, Harley-Davidson's looking at its bottom line. Well, that's its job. They've got to be profitable. You can't run a business in losing money status for lots of years or you go out of business. They've got to be true to their shareholders. So they look at this change, and at the beginning of the tariffs, their stock price jumped way up. It went from about $46 a share up to, right after the tariffs were announced, it jumped up to about $55 a share. That's a big difference. That's a huge jump. And then once the tariffs started taking effect, their stock price started down. And it's stayed down at a level right around 44 for quite some time after that. The reality is that the tariffs hurt the Americans a lot more on American goods, a lot more than it's hurting the steel suppliers, because we still need the steel. We're still buying the steel from overseas because we don't have the capacity to make it all here.
We probably need to do commercials, although we're still on the subject of the sugar high the United States economy is
right,
on,
right,
and the stimulus and Bernanke's comments about it. By the way, he's not the only one. And we want to come back to that, but we'd like to do some commercials. The telephone number in here, if you'd like to call in with a question or thought or something, is 254-773-1400. This is KTEM, and you're listening to the Personal Wealth Coach.
We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400, although we only have about 5 minutes left in the first hour today.
We got another hour after that.
And we were talking...
We had a call during the break, and I wanted to bring it up. The caller asked, what happens with the money for the debts collected for the tariffs?
The taxes collected.
Yeah, the tariff money, as it comes in, yeah. What happens to it? Is it given to manufacturers or what? No, it is given to the U.S. government. It is revenue for the government. And then the next question was, does that lower the deficit? Well, yeah. But
Not much.
The tariffs, as a percentage of the money coming into the government, is a minuscule fraction of 1% of the budget. It's a fraction of 1%.
The issue is that if let's say on the steel tariffs, let's say that now we have a nice 25% tax on steel, and it's coming into the United States. If people in the United States continue to buy the steel at the same rate, and China and mostly Canada continue to export the steel at the same rate, then the money, the tax money on the tariffs would be significant. The problem is you raise the price on something 25% and it causes people to buy less of it.
Yeah.
A lot less of it in this case.
And here's the thing is that what we've known for a long time, and it's being proven again, is that if you put a 10% tariff on something that's in high demand, the price goes up a lot more than 10%. If you put a 25% tariff on something, it goes a lot more than 25. Steel is a great example.
It was up 50%.
Right. 25% tariff caused a 50% jump in prices. So that has a direct bottom line impact on companies that are manufacturing. It's a lot larger impact on an individual company level than it is at the governmental level. And we have another caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to ask you, if I understand you couldn't give me the exact figure, but more or less, what would you say the net worth of Bell County would be if they had to come up with all the money here, put it on the table? What would they be worth?
Yeah, all right. That's a good question. There's about 220,000 people in Bell County, which, by the way, just as a side note, is about the same population as Iceland, the country. So Bell County in central Texas, if you were to take that 220,000 people and assume a net worth, which is always a dangerous thing to do, that's how you would build it. It would be based on averages. The Census Bureau has some data on that. We could put it together. I might be able to tell you what the number is next week, but it's not going to be extremely accurate. And that's something, when these numbers come out, they're based on estimates. They're based on averages of estimates even, and then multiplied by specifics. And because of that, you get some weird numbers. It's not low. We're talking billions upon billions of dollars, because it's not just the people that work here. It's also the companies that are here. Most of those companies are owned by the locals, but we got Walmarts, and you've got car dealerships that are larger chains and smaller chains, and we're about out of time for this hour.
Yeah, and we want to talk some. I do want to get back to the question we had about tariffs and the net effect, because it is a ripple effect that's really important. I think to understand.
Yeah, and I think people are gauging that we're really interested in the subject, watching it happening. We're able to reconfirm things that we looked at history and saw.
Specifically, the issue of the tax cuts. And the tax cuts are critical to understand at this point, particularly since there's a bill in Congress
to make them permanent. Yeah. We're about out of time for this hour. We do give advice on investing and fiduciary advice at that for people of high net worth, or at least comfortable net worth. The phone number to reach us off the air, voicemail on the weekends locally, is
254-947-1111. That's 254-947-1111.
You can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, and we actually read those things. Till next hour, this is